From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we discuss some of the contemporary political issues with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia. I guess we could start with the activity that took place earlier this week. We've been seeing volatility in various stock markets over the last month or two, and then we had what happened with the S&P index earlier this week. And, you know, the sort of background drama, you know, shouts back and forth between Washington and Beijing over trade, and this thing over the Huawei and Iran sanctions and all of that. So let's start there.
Yeah, I think the S&P drop, the largest one-day drop in its history, although as the a lot of analysts of the markets say, it was only a very small part of the stock markets that really showed a decline. But what I think is most significant is that this has been going on over several weeks now. And we read today in the financial papers that that once again, stocks on a global scale are falling. And so everyone says that this decline, it's not just volatility, it's decline. This decline is the result of uncertainty. And the uncertainty is about a whole number of things. Of course, the China-U.S. Trade war, tariff wars, some of that was cooled out a little bit last week in Argentina between Trump and Xi Jinping. But I think the larger thing is that the political uncertainty, be it the political meltdown in Britain, the political and street battles in Paris and throughout France, really political meltdown in Germany. Angela Merkel is on her way out. We don't know how long she will survive. She was the center of stability in Europe, the leader of Europe, as Trump withdrew from any commitment to the European Union. In fact, saw them as a competitor and almost hostile adversary in economic and trade matters. And as the U.S. under Trump has been withdrawing from Europe, they thought that Merkel and Macron of France would be the center of stability. Now Macron is on his way down. I think his polling numbers are in the low 20s, if not below 20%. And then, of course, Italy. A major economy in Europe. The government there is a anti-neoliberal government that is in the process of violating all of the rules of EU membership, especially in terms of debt, percentage of debt to GNP or GDP. So I think that political uncertainty, and then you add to that in the United States, the decline in housing prices, the rise of interest rates, and the tax cuts that were instituted in 2017 are now wearing off, and that's no longer able to stimulate the economy. Right. And the normal 10-year process of boom and bust, the normal economic cycle of capitalist economies, is inserting itself in the economies, especially of the United States. But I think the slowdown of the global economy, including China and not so much India, but China and all of the major European countries, I think we're looking at a global recession, definitely by 2020 at the latest, but probably in 2019, which will add to the political chaos. And so we're in a very difficult moment. The elites politically cannot govern in the old way. The people will not be governed in the old way.
Right.
The question is, how will all of this end?
Yeah, the question is, what does come? Yeah, I'm looking at a chart of the S&P going back to 1998. And when it was in on, say, January 17th of 97, it was at 776.17. Today it's at 2700.06. And where I closed yesterday, I guess. and closed the day before yesterday, because yesterday was a holiday, day, National Day of Mourning. I'm looking at in Election Day 2016, it was just shy of 2100. It peaked at about 29.5 over the last month or so, dropped down to 2600, and is at 27 today. And so, you know, we're not talking about a collapse in any event. You know, it's still at a record high, with the exception of the last 90 days.
What we're talking about is a trend.
Generally, that's correct.
Yeah. And trend is more important at this time than any other measure of anything.
Because the change in trend is, you had almost a straight line up since the last correction, quote unquote. And now you have up, down, up, down, up, down, as it seeks to find level. So that's already a change in the trend from climb to adjustment. And that, of course, signifies either some trauma that, you know, it's reacting to, or something more fundamental. And most likely it's the latter. Now, the timing from the point of view of Trump couldn't be better. If this was going to come, it came after the midterms. He did pretty well in the midterms. But so almost immediately after the midterms that we've got time to settle it before the 2020 elections, as much time as you would be allowed. You know, I mean, it's almost the whole full 2 years. So there's that. I mean, this, all of this depends on exactly what are we seeing. Is this going to be, you know, another, say, qualitative change in the nature of the collapse? You know, which, I mean, I think we're seeing trend, you know, a trend towards that. Even as these markets climb, they signify, in a way, a greater collapse, because stocks and other financial instruments are becoming more and more the only place to invest as the real economy shrinks in many ways.
Right.
And opportunities for investment shrink. You know, we've seen manifestations of that with all the money that's been parked overseas and everywhere else, the incentives that were given to repatriate that money. And when it comes home, it's still a problem. Well, where do we invest it where we can get a return on it? You know, you have these fundamental economic problems that, you know, Marx was describing in the 1840s that still haven't been resolved, and they've you know, just intensified. So you've got that background to all of this. A political condition, as you described, and I think, you know, the avant of that is what we're seeing on the streets of France and the former French colonies, you know, the Franco world, because that's spreading throughout the French-speaking world. And other manifestations of it, as you described, particularly in Italy, where they elected an anti-neoliberal government, and where it's diverging. It's an interesting phenomenon, because you have, on the one hand, description and an accurate one in many ways for the reaction to the EU from these different member nations as being a right wing response. The violations of the you know, economic rules are actually left wing responses, like over debt, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I very, very much agree with what you're saying. If we could just for a moment focus upon the United States and Trump. Trump will not be able, and none of the elites, on the terms of the U.S. Political economy and mode of governing, no one among the elites will be able to hold back the tide of anger and resistance. This will only grow.
Right.
Trump, for the moment, is the instrument, political instrument, of the anti-establishment masses. And they are growing, by the way. Mm. And for this reason, you see a growth, at least according to polls, in Trump support among African Americans. And this is highly significant. I think perhaps as significant as Trump's victory itself. African Americans, in many different ways, abandoning the Democratic Party. We saw it in Florida, the gubernatorial race in Florida with Andrew Gillum. We saw it in Georgia with the gubernatorial candidacy of Stacey Abrams. Yeah. And what did we see? I mean, both were on track to win. But what sunk them in their close races were, one, the numbers of blacks that voted for the Republican candidate, be they white, and the great number of blacks who did not vote at all.
Right.
Which, you know, kind of was the margin of victory. Now, I raise that to say that the anger and alienation of the working class and poor and parts of the lower middle class are at such a fever pitch that literally at some point the masses are going to be calling for a radical change in the nature of the economic system and of the modes of governance of the country. I think we're close to that. And you're right. What is going on in France and in Paris may represent the future, not only of the United States, and I think we're not, you know, we can pretty much predict that will happen, but of England, of other countries in the advanced capitalist world. I think we're in a state of ungovernability, a crisis of legitimacy of the system. When we talked some weeks ago about the collapse of the vital center, you know, Arthur Schlesinger, the historian's concept of the vital center must hold if the system is to be governed. The vital center has collapsed. And what is driving the collapse is the anger of the working people, of black folk, of all of those who have not seen an increase in wages, a standard of living for 40 years. Of the growing poverty, of the growing depression, you know, where again, in 2017, for the third year straight, the American life expectancy declined. And the center of the decline were white people without high school education, which is, I mean, without college educations, which means the working class, the white working class, who are dying from suicides and drug overdoses. These are measures of a growing sense of hopelessness and giving up on the system. The question is to transform the despair into resistance and struggle. So, yeah, that's what I don't think there is. That will not end. It can only grow. Trump could lose the next election, and it will continue to grow.
Yeah, or win it.
Yeah, and it will continue. That's right, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it seems almost irrelevant to the point because
the solutions
that really need to be actualized to these problems are not going to be voted into office on anyone's back.
No.
And and until those problems are solved, they're going to continue to manifest.
Yeah. And you know, and that's what so many people missed after 2016. you know, this smearing of all the white working people and all the white poor as racist, damn near Ku Klux Klan members, and on and on and on, was a way of dismissing them and saying that the Trump election was really an anomaly, and we have to get back to a form of, quote, liberal democracy, and the left participated with the neoliberal elite and, of course, the deep state, including the FBI and CIA and the rest of them, right, in fighting to get back to what they considered normal. Right. We're not going to be back to normal. The left, what calls itself the left, was completely wrong, had nothing to say to the great mass of people, are not connected to them, by the way.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's what we're looking at.
Right.
And we have to look it dead in the face and not be afraid of it.
Yeah.
This is the way the systemic breakdown is going to happen in the United States and throughout the capitalist world.
That's right. This is what it looks like.
This is what it looks like.
Well, you know, so we've had, we'll go to France for a moment, just because it seems to be so, mm-hmm, you know, further developed in a way, you know, like more matured in a way to where it's actually, mm-hmm, in the streets at the moment. Mm-hmm. You go back over the history of France, you know, people forget that there have been these uprisings, revolutions, even in Europe. With the working class, you know, which was much more highly developed in Europe than it was in the United States in the 19th century, you know, leading a lot of it. You had in France alone, you had the 1789 revolution, the Paris Commune in 1871, the, you know, first socialist revolution in Europe, really. And then Vichy in 1940 and what happened in 1968. And mm-hmm, in each case, you had like this thunderous activity on the ground and then a resolution of it through the society that ended up leading where we are now, putting the same, mm-hmm, you know, powers back in power, in essence.
Mm-hmm.
There's a history of how that happened, both the inside history by the people that were able to manipulate events back then that still know that and haven't necessarily shared all of that information with the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there is the, you know, science of social control that has, mm-hmm, evolved and is now plugged into supercomputers and data points on every human being, mm-hmm, on the planet. And that is who will be manipulating events in the defense of the order in France, Italy, wherever else this breaks out as it breaks out, with a global view of the whole thing and an atomic set of data, you know, all the way down to the individual. And on the other hand, I wonder if any of us even know that there's a game board on our side.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult battle to conduct when the sides are so lopsided.
Well, you know, the other thing is how one understands history.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in moments like this, history becomes a real useful tool in our understanding of the present and future. You know, you're right about the rise of the class conflict over at least 250 years in Europe. And we could go back a little earlier, perhaps. But, you know, this trajectory. And I think the key moment is World War II. And maybe we could say that whole period of World War I,
yeah,
to the end of World War II with the Great Depression in between there. And then Europe rebuilds itself and new forms of rule and governance are locked in. A big section of the European working class is bought off. That's the purpose of neocolonialism.
Right.
And in a certain way, for a while, the capitalist ruling classes of Europe and America shared some of their profits, especially those that come from the super exploitation, right, of the colonial world, shared that, right, with parts of the working class. And so, right, you know, you get this idea of the middle class as a replacement to the working class,
right,
and such. But now that has come to an end. there's no more to share. And the other thing is the 1%, 1/10 of 1% became even more greedy.
Right.
And they saw even more reckless ways to make billions and almost trillions of dollars. So they financialized everything. And and the work of producing things was exported to China and Vietnam and the Philippines and parts of Africa and on and on and on. And then, of course, all of the coups and wars, ethnic and other kind of wars in Africa, stoked and financed by the West so that they could maintain control of the resources of Africa and to keep them cheap. But this is coming to an end. And it's ironic that the great challenge to it is now in the centers of world capitalism, not on what was often called the periphery in the colonial or third world. I think, and so we have to consider a collapse, but then the possibility of prolonged chaos in the major capitalist countries where there are political and other kinds of battles of every imaginable sort taking place. France is one example. But, you know, the street violence will probably cool out, but that doesn't resolve the political crises.
Right.
England is the same thing. I mean, England is in a political meltdown, and so is the United States. So this is what we're looking at.
Right. Yeah, if you look at Paris, for example, okay, so it's December. It's going to be winter in a week or two. And so everybody goes indoors and, you know, does that for the next few months. And then in spring, you have a resurgence of what had happened. It'll be, you know, 51 years in this spring from the Paris spring of 1968. And so that now people have been organizing since then. The problems that gave rise to the, you know, that fueled the uprising this time continue to percolate. The conditions of people is more difficult rather than less. I mean, this was, the spark for this was actually prospective, you know, a tax about to be imposed that is now, you know, off the table for a while, as opposed to something that had already been suffered and endured by people, which is somehow cured. The actual fuel for this are the things, of course, that have been suffered by people for a long time, with the austerity that's been imposed on Europe for a long time. And that condition is only going to continue to deteriorate. No one's addressed that at all.
No, this is it. And each country will have its own form of political chaos and meltdown. The United States will be the unique place because the American social and political economies are very different, very peculiar, because of the history of chattel slavery and the ongoing history of black oppression, the ongoing reality of black oppression, which, you know, you have...
It's an internal version of what you described with the colonial period externally in Europe.
Absolutely. And you have this black proletariat, which exists in two worlds, both the black world and the third world, as they call it, and as a part of the American working class itself.
Right.
So it channels through itself a unique consciousness, which if it influences growing sections of the white working class, can create a very, very specific, peculiar, unique form of resistance. But it, I think, if I were to put a theoretical analysis on it, political theoretical analysis, I would say that going forward, from the standpoint of the masses and of the working class, almost everything depends upon what the black proletariat collectively does, because it can move the day. For example, on the immigration debate, the Democrats think they are using the immigration question against Trump and that they will widen their electorate among Latinos and Hispanics, especially those from Mexico and Central America. But in the process, and recent polling data points this out, in the process, they are losing the black worker.
Right.
Because the black worker and poor are the principal victims of open borders and mass immigration.
Right.
They're the ones that lose jobs. And so they, and very interestingly also, are the Latino poor and working classes.
Right.
Who do not agree with open borders. So the Democrats, say Kamala Harris, or from California, or Berto from Texas, the young guy that ran for Senate.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is that if they think immigration is their path to electoral victory and to the presidency, they got it very wrong. Because in the process, they are losing the most loyal part of the Democratic Party, and that is the black vote. And they are losing it rapidly. At least, you know, one poll, I think it was a Harvard-Harris poll, showed that 85% of black people polled said that they were for a cap upon legal immigration at 1 million a year. 54%
wow.
said that they were for capping immigration to 250,000 a year or none.
Wow.
I mean, this dramatic shift away from the Democratic Party's orthodoxy and the appearance of liberalism is dramatic. I would even say that even if you take the so-called social democratic part of the Democratic Party, they do not have the loyalty of black people. We saw that with the unconditioned loyalty of black people. I think that's partially what we saw in Florida with Andrew Gillum's, who proclaimed himself a social democrat. Black people have not yet found a party. They're moving away from the Democrats in dramatic numbers, which reshapes the whole electoral process and its future in the United States, and the future really of the two-party system.
So,
forgive me for talking too long.
I'm just, there's a lot. I'm trying to wrap my mind around something that we can encapsulate. We got about a minute and a half left, but because it's an excellent description and analysis of what. What's going on right now?
Mm-hmm.
The response that keeps coming out of the Democratic Party seems like it gets churned out of the same ad agencies every time
right.
they have one of these electoral catastrophes, and I would say that that's what they've just endured again. They didn't get, you know, they're going to be able to impeach Trump. That's about it. Not remove
that's
him,
right.
maybe impeach
Don,
him. Yeah.
Don, they have no message
yeah.
for the people. They are beholden to that part of the elite, the neoliberal, financial, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, Hollywood elite
right.
that are out of touch with the masses of the people.
Yeah, I would say it's
they
not just
no
messages. Yes, it's not just message. I think that for millions of people in the United States, they're not looking for a message. They're looking for some money to pay their bills, to pay their
That's
mortgage
right.
or their rent.
That's right.
They need food, they need health care, and they need relief for the educational debt, and they need that now. And the Democrats, nobody's offering that, with the possible exception, at least rhetorically, of Trump. And until that changes, nothing else is going to change. We got to stop there. So, Tony, I guess we can pick it up here next week unless something else happens between now and then. Thanks a lot
right.
for your time.
What I want to talk about is war and peace and the domestic politics.
Good. That's where we'll start next week. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, my brother. Peace.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.